as I wait, heart of God.
My new life. Oh my gosh, wasn't Easter amazing? Well, actually, I wasn't there yet. It's Thursday for us, or Tuesday, but I am so looking forward to Easter. I don't know how, Jonathan, you are going to get through your sermon. I mean, we have 5 songs, we have 3 baptisms, all of it's going to be glorious, and then we have this incredible passage out of John chapter 20. It's a lot to handle on a Sunday.
Yes, it's going to be exciting, I'm really excited about this passage. I think it's a great passage, I look at these things every Easter, and it never gets old.
Mm.
It's just so exciting. Now, and once again, we've given we had a meeting with all our growth group leaders last week, and we talked about this first question, the close reading, and everybody was saying that in general, people really enjoying this question, and I for one am really glad that you're really enjoying it, because I think it really is. I mean, certainly in our group, sometimes it takes as much time as all the other questions, because it enables us to engage with stuff that perhaps that really are the questions we're asking, maybe weren't covered in the sermon or aren't covered in any of the questions. And you know, I just remind you, the reason why we started these groups, is so that we can start really engaging with the Bible ourselves. And that's what really excites me about it. So I'm really glad about that question. So I hope you'll enjoy it. But our second question is entitled "Seeing is Believing," which is the sermon title. But David has put a question mark on the
screen. A little preemptive question mark.
It's, Thomas is not the only one who doubted before seeing Jesus. Mary and the disciples had their doubts brushed aside by a personal visit from Jesus. Have you ever wished for such a personal visit? However, were there some who saw Jesus' miracles but remained blind to his identity? And who or what plants faith in our hearts? Our sight or our God? What does the Bible teach about those who, like us, have not seen, but trust God and take him at his word anyway?
So it is true, and you know it, that Thomas gets a bad rap. The poor guy, he's up there sitting in heaven, and there's all these Indian believers probably because of him, and here we are down in our churches calling him Doubting Thomas, and he's like, man, Jesus, is this fair? It's not fair that he's called Doubting Thomas. Yes, he is used as an illustration, a powerful illustration by the author of John's Gospel to point to the victory of faith, the triumph of faith conquering doubt. But he's not the only one, as Jonathan just read in this question, who had their doubts and had their understandings. Isn't it true that every one of the disciples, especially his top three, Peter, James, and John, abandoned Jesus when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane and arrested? They ran away. One of the disciples ran away naked. Go read about it in one of the Gospels. Everyone deserted the shepherd when he was struck. That is to say, the sheep left him.
And we always compare Thomas to the other disciples. Well, they'd all, before Thomas, there's no evidence that they were completely faith-filled believing before they actually saw Jesus. But we'll talk about that.
And of course, Thomas says, I will never believe unless I see the hole in his hands and the hole in his side. Well, in verse 20 of chapter 20, Jesus goes and he shows the disciples his hands and his side. This is Jesus' first appearance to the disciples, and Thomas wasn't there.
Right.
So the disciples got to see the very thing that Thomas demanded to see.
Yeah.
So anyways, we love you, Thomas, up there. Can't wait to meet you in person. A couple more words,
okay.
I think, though. I think we've solidly let Thomas off the hook, but let's see just how we fit into this question. And we do so by the probably frequent desire in the heart of honest Christians to have really seen the physical Jesus before us. I know this is me thinking, man, I wish I was there at the Sermon on the Mount just to hear him speak and to hear his parables. If I heard that, man, I would really believe, and yes, I do believe it. Gosh, my faith would be strong if I saw the risen Jesus. Well, we pose a couple of different responses to that desire for you to consider. First off, there were many in Jesus' day who saw his miracles but were so hard-hearted and so stubborn that they denied their implications. Top of that list, we know, was the Pharisees and some of the Jewish leaders. And in John chapter 9, there's a story about Jesus healing a man born blind. Now, it's one thing to heal a blind person. It's another thing to heal someone who is born blind. And that's a point that John makes there. And that chapter concludes by this strong denunciation of those who deny the implication of Jesus's messiahship as someone who can heal someone born blind, a way of transferring new creation, really. Jesus says, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see," that is the formerly blind man, "and those who see may become blind," obviously the Pharisees. Mm. So again, we're playing with the same metaphor of sight here. And then our second response to someone who says, "Oh, if only I was there when Jesus was around, or maybe if he were to come back and give me a personal conversation," our second response is, well, consider what actually makes faith grow inside of our hearts. Is it sight? Or is it God himself? Who does the initial planting? Well, in John 6, we read that no one can come to Jesus unless the Father personally draws him. So it's really, it's the Father who initiates faith in our hearts anyways. So we don't need these external signs nearly as much as we suppose that we do. And lastly, Jesus pronounces a beatitude, a blessing on those who have not seen. He says to Thomas, "Have you believed because you've seen me, Tommy? Well, guess what? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed." And you know what, guys? If you believe in Jesus, you're part of that group. And I think that's solid encouragement for us.
Oh, yeah, it is. And it's a good reason for you to put that question that preemptive question
That's
mark.
That's right.
That you
firmly placed.
Yes. Now our third question is called Spirit-Filled and Sent. "As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you," Jesus told his disciples. The Gospel of John constantly refers to Jesus as the one sent from heaven. Who now has the sent one become? Do you think of yourself as being on mission? How does seeing God as a missionary help us better fill that role?
Right. So there's this curious little passage at Jesus' first appearance to his disciples, as recorded in the Gospel of John, where he shows up, he says, "Hey, check out my hand and my side. All right, guys, this is what's up. The Father sent me into this world, and now I am sending you." Now, this idea of Jesus being the sent one is so prevalent in the Gospel of John, you guys. You could find, it wouldn't surprise me if you could find 24 references to Jesus being sent by the Father into this world. And take a look now at just a couple. "For the Father did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save it." That's John 3. John 4, very next chapter. "Jesus said to them, 'My food is through the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work.'" John chapter 6. "For I have come down from heaven not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." And of course, those could be multiplied. So Jesus, more than the other Gospels, is portrayed as someone who is sent from heaven to do a special job, a special task while on earth. But now, most plainly here in this chapter, the sent one becomes the sending one. Other references to the high priestly prayer say, "As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world on a mission, on a task." And I just think that the idea of mission and God as a missionary is a really fascinating subject in biblical study, and it's so encouraging to think of God as someone who is earnestly pursuing us, who desires us and has gone at great lengths to draw us to himself.
And there's lots of conversations over the last few years of the role of the church as a missional church, that we are a church that is not just created for ourselves, but we're created to be missionally involved in the world.
So right. Jesus
is an This is a really important question.
He says, I am sending you into the world.
Yeah.
Right, right. I'm not asking the Father to take them out of the world, as I will be soon, Jesus says, but to keep them there and to continue the work that I started.
Mm. And the last question, which I always love this verse in John chapter 20, because it really says, so often there are parts of Scripture that you say, I wonder why they told us this.
That's right.
And I wonder why they didn't tell us this.
Sure.
But John makes this very clear. John 20, verse 31 reveals the grand purpose statement of John's entire gospel. These signs are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John records specific signs, 7 of them, to engender a specific faith that Jesus is the Messiah and the Son of God. How did you first come to believe that Jesus is your God? Has God worked subsequent signs in your life which grew your faith? Have you considered how a testimony of these signs might encourage the faith of others?
Yeah, so one thing that's been so fun for me and has really deepened my understanding of the Bible is just to consider the intentionality of the authors. The Gospels themselves, and really any book of the Bible, isn't just whatever he can happen to remember that Jesus said, I should probably include this, and let's make sure we get it all in the right order and everything. No, there's an intense intentionality that these authors, guided by the Spirit, have structured their gospel to portray a very specific message. And as Jonathan just said, that message is as plain as day here in the last two verses of John chapter 20. He says that now the signs that Jesus did, why he did so many of them that you couldn't... if you took all the paper in the world and made them books of all the signs that Jesus did, you couldn't fill all the libraries of the world. He did so many. But these signs that I have written for you in my gospel, I wrote these for the purpose that you may believe, and that by believing you may have life. That's John's purpose statement. Signs reveal the identity of Jesus. You believe in that, and then you get life through him.
And that explains so many things about the fact that John's gospel is so different than the other gospels. As we've said, John's gospel is written significantly later, and in all probability, he assumed that his readers had probably read the other gospels, and so he didn't need to repeat some stuff, but he just had to focus on the stuff which he believed would cause us to believe in his name.
Right. And again, I think that betrays the supposition that we need to include all the details.
Right.
They covered this, I don't need to include that. That's not really how we should think about how books are formed.
And we don't need to turn around and say, well, John didn't say that, so who are we supposed to believe? There's no reason why... There's every reason to believe all of them, because they were different people, and they wrote to different audiences, and they remembered different things. I mean, if David and I go to watch a Giants game, he may remember one set of things, I may remember another set of things. They're both entirely valid.
And far more importantly about what they remembered or didn't remember is the fact that they have different purposes.
Right.
Matthew wrote to do a specific thing, and the things that he wrote aren't just all that he could possibly remember about Jesus said, or maybe governed by the length of a scroll that he could obtain, but by what he was trying to do, what he was trying to produce in the heart of his readers. And John
here we say what
that
John was doing
very clearly, yeah.
What he was doing.
As a result of signs, and there's 7 signs recorded in the first half of John's gospel. And now we ask about your own life and your own process towards belief. We have very plainly recorded the moment where Thomas believed that Jesus was the Messiah and the Son of God. There, after Jesus showed up to that faithful believer, Thomas says, "My Lord and my God."
Which is one of the most unequivocal confessions in the whole of Scripture.
Of the Trinity, yeah. Or at the very least of the divinity of Christ. So incredibly strong that we have that on the mouth of someone that we
We call doubting.
I know. Yeah, he's awesome. But then we kind of turn the corner a little bit, and we ask, has God worked any signs in your life which helped your faith to grow, perhaps answers to prayer, or maybe miracles in your life or the lives of those around you? And perhaps how a testimony of those signs might encourage faith in others. Now, mind you, the whole book of John is a testimony of signs encouraged to produce faith. Our lives can be the very same thing.
I hope that you're going to really enjoy these discussions. I'm really looking forward to preaching on Sunday. I always look forward to preaching on Easter Sunday, and we're going to have, by now, 3 new people will have been baptized by the time you
listen
do these
this,
discussions,
yeah.
And that's going to be great. Well, I wish you, I hope you've all had a really wonderful Easter, and that you will take on the challenge to believe and proclaim this good news to world that needs it so much.
As I wait, heart of God.